We go now to an open mic segment. That's when we ask someone that we might interview ourselves on Morning Edition to get behind the mic, to quiz someone they find fascinating. In a moment, Will Wright takes the host chair. You could think of him as the Steven Spielberg of game design. He created The Sims, the most successful computer game ever. More recently, the game Spore, in which players create virtual single-celled organisms and, you might call it godlike, evolve those organisms into more complex forms of life. And, Will, you're joining us from your home in Oakland, California.
Yes.
So let's begin with who you chose to interview.
I chose Edward O. Wilson, basically a biologist that's inspired a huge amount of my work. I read every book he's written, and one of the early games I did was SimAnt, which was based upon a lot of his work on ants. So I've always been very fascinated with biology and evolution, and so I kind of came into the interview with all these questions about evolution that I wanted to ask him, but it was interesting because his first response was, oh, I thought we were going to talk about games. And, you know, he clearly had a very strong interest in talking about, you know, the way games were going to impact education, which is really wonderful to hear from him.
He may have wanted to talk about games rather than the sort of subject of evolution, but he certainly is one of the most prominent names in evolution. Some people call him Darwin's heir.
Well, it's actually interesting how he's taken kind of the genetic evolution and brought it out into higher and higher levels. I think one of his big goals has been to unify science, especially with like the humanities. And he's one of the few scientists that really, you know, kind of have the guts to even try to do that.
Let's get to the interview then. And why don't you tell us what you ask him first?
Well, I was very curious to find out if he saw a role for games in the educational process.
Well, I'll go to an even more radical position, and that is I think games are the future in education. We're going through a rapid transition now. We're about to leave print textbooks behind. For example, I envision visits to different ecosystems that the student could actually enter, taking this path, going to that hill with an instructor. And that could be a rainforest, it could be a tundra, it could be a Jurassic forest. And with all of that experience, I think wonders could be accomplished.
It feels like almost a very different mode of education, because traditionally education is, you know, the teacher stands up and broadcasts information and the students are expected to absorb it. And, you know, in some sense, it's putting the kid at the center of the educational experience instead of on the other side of the wall.
That's right. We are teaching kids, for the most part, the wrong way. The way to do it should be the ancient way, the way human mind is programmed to learn. When children went out in Paleolithic times, and now we're talking back millions of years, they went with adults. They learned everything they needed to learn by participating in the process. You know, that's the next step beyond the game step, the virtual reality step, that then we can have a lot more real reality for students.
So you see this as possibly a stepping stone, so a kid might get actually the motivation to go out and have these real experiences.
Yeah.
Ed, I'm curious, at what point in your life did you realize you were going to become a biologist?
Maybe it was when I got stung by a velvet ant at the age of 3. That's a viciously stinging insect. But I'm only exaggerating slightly. I developed this interest when I was 9 years old, and I wanted to be one of those National Geographic writers who could tell us with beautiful pictures about beetles, winged jewels of the tropics.
It's interesting hearing you talk about this, because it's clear that, you know, you not only have a passion for these subjects, but you in some sense have a reverence for them as well. And it sounds like you almost had that realization at a fairly early age. Do you think that's common?
No. I don't think so. Because I had very permissive parents and very permissive schools, I was able to spend a huge amount of my time in the field. People didn't know what I was doing, really. I got such a feeling for it, of the swamps, the riverbanks. That's what came to be the focus of my life. So naturally, when I got to college and I learned about evolution, that was the epiphany, that all this chaotic information I'd been storing up could be fitted together by evolution and what was then the new synthesis, when it was really new in the late 1940s, I just lapped it up.
It sounds like when you finally were exposed to, you know, the theory of evolution and an epiphany, as you describe it. It's interesting reading your books. As a writer, you sound just remarkably reasonable in the way you approach life and the variety of subjects that you kind of address. Yet it's interesting that occasionally in your career, you come across ideas that are received with a lot of controversy.
I never was afraid of controversy, but I have to admit that when I created the first synthesis of sociobiology and treated it as a discipline, that's what the subject is really all about. That's what sociobiology means, the discipline of the study of the biological basis of social behavior. I didn't realize that there was a minefield out there that I would find if I brought humans into it, and the passion with which the notion that human beings have a human nature that has a biological base would excite. And that was a huge controversy. It's all over now. People have a human nature based on biology. But in those days, it created a tremendous amount of anger, actually.
I'm kind of curious, as a biologist, in biology or evolution, if there was one thing that you don't know about that subject that you wish you could know, what would it be? What is, like, the biggest unanswered question in biology that you would love the answer to?
Well, it's the one I'm working on right now, and it is the origin of altruistic social behavior. And forgive me if this sounds grandiose, but, you know, since philosophers don't seem to want to ever ask it anymore, I'll ask it. It's what's inscribed on Paul Gauguin's Tahitian masterpiece on the canvas. Where did we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? And we're not going to have any answers for that until we've done a lot more science and also integration of science with the other great branches of learning, the social sciences, the humanities. And one of the most important aspects of it is, what is the nature of the evolution that finally created the human species?
Well, I want to thank you for your time, Ed. Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Will. I hope I'll meet you sometime. Maybe walking together through that Jurassic forest.
I'll start working on it, yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot.
And that was biologist E.O. Wilson of Harvard University being interviewed on Morning Edition's Open Mic by game designer Will Wright. Will Wright, thanks so much for taking Morning Edition's Open Mic.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And you can hear more of Will Wright's conversation with E.O. Wilson at npr.org.
So, incandescents are getting more efficient, but how do they compare to the other options out there? Compact fluorescents and LEDs, or light-emitting diodes. How do they compare in efficiency and cost and in environmental impact? Well, for some answers, we're joined by Celia Cooper-Smith-Lehrman, who is the deputy home editor at Consumer Reports, and in their October issue, due out tomorrow, they put compact fluorescent bulbs to the test. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
And let's start with efficiency. How do these new incandescents compare to what you've seen out there from compact fluorescents?
They're still far less efficient than compact fluorescent bulbs and less efficient than LEDs. And we actually tested one of these hybrid bulbs, a Philips Halogena, which also says it's going to save 30% of the energy. And it did. The problem is that these bulbs are very expensive. We paid $9 for two bulbs. So even at 30% savings in terms of energy, these bulbs are never going to pay for themselves.
Well, let's talk cost. Compact fluorescents have come down a lot in price, but are they a better deal than incandescents?
Yes, they are. Long term, they're a much better deal. They've come down in price quite a bit. We had some of our Consumer Reports best buys were about $1.50 a bulb. Those can save you $56 over the life of the bulb. And when you think of the fact that the average house has about 40 light bulbs in it, roughly, you really can start seeing some significant savings.
Although I gather the life of the CFL is not quite so long as might have been advertised when they first hit the market.
They're getting much better, and that's one of the things we also found in our test, was that the Energy Star bulbs did perform better. So we're seeing that they are starting to, you know, they're all going to perform and last much longer than an average incandescent bulb. The incandescent bulbs last about 900 to 1,000 hours, And all of the bulbs that we had in our ratings were still burning brightly after 3,000 hours, and we keep them going, so we're going to update that. But in our previous tests, we had bulbs that burned for 10,000 hours.
Now, a big downside to compact fluorescents is the issue of toxicity. They contain mercury, one is warned to never simply throw them away. Bad news for folks who buy them hoping that they'll be planet-friendly, but is that a reasonable argument in favor of incandescents or LEDs?
Well, certainly not. I don't think really in favor of incandescents, because you're saving so much electricity, and that electricity is being generated often by coal-powered electric plants, and that's dumping a lot of the same pollutants, mercury, into the air. The compact fluorescent bulbs contain a very small amount of mercury, 5 milligrams or less for the Energy Star bulbs. And 5 milligrams is actually a very small amount. When we tested it, most of them actually contain significantly less than the 5 milligrams. And 5 milligrams itself is actually the amount you would need to cover the tip of a pen or a pencil.
Now, here's another criterion for judging light bulbs: aesthetics. Incandescents make great light. You can put them on the dimmer. Can CFLs or LEDs ever come close to that kind of warm light?
Well, you know, CFLs have gotten a lot closer. You have to know, how do you find the CFL with that same light quality? And that's one of the things that people do. They confuse brightness with color and light quality. Color, how blue or white or yellow the light is actually defined by the temperature of the light. And if you look for a CFL that's 2700 K, that is pretty close to an incandescent bulb. So it's just important to look for that number so that you can see that. And a lot of that number is now on the packaging. It's required on the packaging of Energy Star bulbs.
Well, Celia Cooper-Smith-Lehrman, Deputy Home Editor of Consumer Reports, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
This is NPR, National Public Radio. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Noah Adams. It seems like Google can be a way to find out pretty much anything about anything. But the folks at Google know that a lot of the world's knowledge is not indeed on the web. It's in books. So they created Google Book Search. And now Google is in the midst of complex negotiations with authors and publishers about rights, as NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Google didn't ask the authors. They just started scanning books. Google co-founder Sergey Brin defends this act of ambition by citing the fires at the Library of Alexandria in ancient Egypt. Historians believe those fires destroyed one of the ancient world's greatest repositories of knowledge.
These books do get lost all the time, and there are floods and there are fires. This information is not backed up, essentially, in the world, so it's important to process it.
It also happens to be Google's corporate mission to make all of the world's knowledge searchable.
The books were a very important part of that, and so much of the wisdom of humanity is captured in that.
Since 2004, Google has scanned more than 10 million books from 40 libraries. When you do a search on Google, you already get results from some of the scanned books, but you can only see a tiny snippet of the book. That's in part because of a copyright lawsuit by the Authors Guild and the Association of American Publishers. They reached a settlement for paying the authors. It's still waiting for approval from a federal judge. Writers who don't want to be covered by the agreement can opt out, and some will, like travel writer Edward Hasbrook, author of The Practical Nomad.
Publishers have cleverly used this settlement to effectuate a massive clawback of rights, of control, and of revenue share.
Hasbrook says revenue sharing practices for the electronic rights to books are still evolving, and the settlement will take away his right to negotiate directly with his publisher.
We can take it as a given that if this settlement is approved, many publishers are likely to claim many electronic rights that they don't own.
Hasbrook says that the Authors Guild doesn't represent the interests of lesser-known authors like himself. The Guild doesn't represent the interests of academic authors either, says Professor Pamela Samuelson of UC Berkeley Law School.
They don't share the academic values that I think would lead people like me to prefer and want to maximize public access rather than maximize revenues.
Samuelson doesn't want money for her work. She just wants people to see it. Right now, a Google book search turns up only a short segment of the book. If the settlement is approved, you can pay money to see the entire work, or authors like Samuelson can opt out of payments. Author Hasbrook thinks digitizing books is so important that the government should be doing it, not Google.
These are worthy goals, which I and most authors would enthusiastically endorse the cause of before Congress for a proper legislative solution.
Nothing is stopping Congress, says Google co-founder Sergey Brin.
We'd definitely love to be able to send Google search users there or to any number of other resources. But the fact is, there are no other such ambitious projects.
This is true, and some critics of the settlement say despite its flaws, they would rather find a way to make it work. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties group, is raising objections to the settlement. But EFF attorney Cindy Cohn thinks we'd be better off having something rather than having nothing. Cohn, who grew up in a small town, remembers when she felt limited by the size of her local library.
Google's creating a digital library that's going to create a tremendously more access to the world's books than we'll have if we sit around and wait for 10 years for something better.
On October 7th, the judge will hold a hearing. He could still ask the parties to amend the agreement before he approves it. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
For many people, the dangers of texting while driving are blatantly obvious. And yet lots of people still do it all over the world. An extremely graphic new video shows just how lethal it can be. We'll hear that public service announcement in a moment. It was made in Britain, and thanks to YouTube, it's gone viral. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
Three young friends are in a car, laughing, the radio's playing, traveling down a two-lane highway.
Hi, Jay. My mate Jules fancies you.
The driver is texting. She takes her eyes off the road to look for her friend's address. Three cars are involved in this terrifying depiction. We don't find out how many are killed in the crash, but its gruesome nature leaves enough for the imagination.
Mommy, Daddy, wake up!
The video was made by filmmaker Peter Watkins Hughes in collaboration with a local police force and a high school in Wales. It'll be shown in schools throughout the UK this fall. Watkins Hughes posted the video on YouTube so that a BBC producer friend in London could see it. Within weeks, it went viral.
I think the film strikes a chord around the globe because it is a new global problem.
Recent studies show texting while driving is on the rise and that it increases the risk of crashing more than talking on a cell phone while driving. In the U.S., texting while driving is illegal in just 14 states.
You know, we've got young people and people using mobile phones who are dying needlessly.
There have been some visceral reactions to the video PSA online. One wrote, "It scared the bleep out of me." Another said, "It should be aired on every TV station in the world multiple times." 25-year-old Mark Hughes of Collegeville, Pennsylvania, admits that he texts while he drives. But he says he was pretty shocked by the video.
I thought the video was pretty graphic. It definitely caused you to take a step back, to cause you to take a pause. That's something that really could happen.
So will he stop texting while driving?
I can't say that's going to stop me from texting, honestly.
And for Rob Foss, that's the problem.
I watched about the first couple of minutes of it, and I've seen this sort of stuff so many times, I didn't watch the rest of it.
Foss is director of the Center for the Study of Young Drivers at the University of North Carolina. He says scare tactics don't change something as complex as human behavior, even when people declare that it will.
When you talk to the public, and especially when you talk to teenagers, they say, oh, yes, that would make me behave differently. Well, people don't know what would make them behave differently.
Philip Pavero is more hopeful. He's the sheriff of Ontario County in New York State, where in 2007, five young women were killed in a head-on collision. The driver's cell phone was sending and receiving text messages within a minute of the crash. Pavero believes PSAs like this one should be part of a larger effort to get people to stop texting while driving.
Each little piece, each PSA, each presentation by a law enforcement personnel, they're all spokes in this wheel of prevention. Hopefully we'll get the message out and we'll see substantial reductions in this type of behavior by drivers.
Even skeptic Rob Foss believes some good may come of the texting while driving PSA. It might get the attention of lawmakers. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
When gas electric hybrid cars like the Toyota Prius first became popular, one of the questions people asked was, can it go as fast as a regular car? Can it even go 55? Turns out that at some racetracks, electric dragsters are beating their competitors that run on gas. Colin Fogarty with Northwest News Network took a ride with some electric drag racing pioneers in Portland, Oregon.
The $1 million Ferrari Enzo can do 0 to 60 in about 3.5 seconds. So can Mike Willman's 1978 Ford Pinto.
I tore it all down, took the whole front end down, took the engine. The infamous exploding gas tank is gone. Now the batteries take up the back trunk area where the gas tank used to be, as well as the back seat area.
Willman takes me out for a spin in his electric vehicle, or EV, on some Portland back roads.
What was that?
That was the sound of smoke being made from the tires.
My head went back.
Yeah. Now you got the EV grin too, I see.
The EV grin?
EV grin. First time you're driving an EV and you feel the power that things have.
I can smell burning rubber.
That is the smell of burning rubber, yes. That's the only emissions that this car makes.
After our whiplash-inducing jaunt, Willman parks his Pinto at the Portland driveway of his friend and fellow EV aficionado, John Wayland. Wayland has his own homemade electric dragster. It's a Datsun that he's hoping can change the image of electric cars.
I'd like to say that the electric car has been in the hands of the wrong people for too long, the environmentalists. Now, I am an environmentalist. I like trees, but I don't hug them. You know, I love animals, I love clean air, but I like to have fun, and I realized you got to make the electric car fun and exciting.
Wayland and Willman are leaders in the National Electric Drag Racing Association. They share one love, beating the pants off gas-powered hot rods.
It's fun. You go out there, it blows people's minds, you know.
Hot rods, souped-up cars, and EVs line up for the regular Friday night drag races at Portland International Raceway. The winner of this race is a Tesla Roadster. Its owner is entrepreneur Paul Gulick. He bought the $100,000 sports car from the California-based electric car company, Tesla. Gulick seems as surprised as anyone to have won the race.
I have just now done my very first drag race, and I beat the gas-powered guy that I was up against by a mile, and I got to run it up to over 100 miles an hour and did it in under 13 seconds from a dead stop, so that was fun.
The gas-powered hot rod Gulick beat was a menacing turbocharged Volkswagen Beetle. Its owner, Travis Matney, says he had no idea he was up against an electric car.
I was impressed at how well that car ran. It definitely put me in my place.
Even so, it ended up a mixed night for electric dragsters. Pioneers like John Wayland and Mike Willman saw big glitches and lost power altogether a few times. Wayland blamed it on the lead-acid batteries they use.
We're blowing some batteries and have the problem, but we're using old technology batteries. The guys with the lithium batteries are not having any problems. They're running strong.
Tesla and the major car companies are all moving to lithium batteries. They're more reliable and more powerful. They're also much more expensive. For NPR News, I'm Colin Fogarty in Portland.
The
videos that become the next big thing on YouTube can now cash in on their 15 minutes of fame. The website recently announced that users who create just one viral video are eligible for advertising partnerships with the company. YouTube wants to expand its revenue options, and it hopes videos like David DeVore's will attract more advertisers. His video of his young son's foggy behavior after a dental visit has been viewed more than 28 million times.
Do I have stitches?
Yes.
On my teeth?
Yeah, don't touch it. Don't.
Why can't I touch it?
Because it'll mess up the stitches.
You have four eyes.
Yeah.
David DeVore joins us from member station WUCF in Orlando, Florida, to tell us more. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Tell us how this partnership works. What do you have to do?
Have a funny video and just let it go crazy like ours.
And the ads that go up there, you actually get some money for that.
Right. I believe it's every time somebody clicks through the ads, we get a portion of the revenue share.
How much money do you imagine you've made so far with this?
Well, I looked it up and we've made a little over $25,000.
That's significant considering.
Absolutely. I mean, it was found money. Just kind of a side note, I've been in real estate since 2005, and obviously we took quite a hit down here in Florida, and this extra income couldn't have come at a better time.
How many hits did your video have when YouTube offered you the deal?
Well, that was the funny thing. We put it on the first weekend of February just to share it with family and friends, and by that Tuesday, we had 3 million views.
How did they approach you?
It was just a small notification on the channel. Everyone has a channel or a page. And it was just a button to push to go through a set of a process to become a YouTube partner.
Now, your son was 7 at the time you filmed this.
Right.
And you were just doing it because...
Well, it was a combination of things. This was a pretty serious procedure, and my wife couldn't be there. And so I just decided to videotape the entire day. And I just put it on YouTube to be able to share with family and friends a lot easier with their link.
Yeah. Did you have any hesitations about doing this? I mean, if you put it on YouTube, there always is a chance that the world is going to see it.
Even in hindsight, I don't. Even at the time, I wasn't aware. I know that there's privacy settings that you can limit how many people see it, but it defeated the purpose. What I was trying to do was to make it easier.
Did your son see it before you did that?
Oh, yeah. We watched it that night, and he just thought it was just hilarious. And it really helped him have a calmer reaction to having go to the dentist.
Huh. Given the ads now that are on that site, there are people who have complained that the ads don't always fit the videos. What's your experience been?
Mine has been positive. I mean, 90% of it has been dental related, you know, but the occasional pizza or Domino's, whatever it might be, they'll post it on there.
Are you making any more videos?
Well, we tried to do a few more, and those have garnered some success, nowhere near what we did. But to be honest, they were just kind of more of a reaction. Well, you have to put a new video up. But we may do some in the future, but it'll just have to be what we want, and not just because we can.
David DeVore recently became an advertising partner with YouTube after his video of his son after a dental appointment went viral. David DeVore joined us from WUCF in Orlando, Florida. Thank you very much, David.
Well, thank you for having me.
And give my regards to your son.
I sure will.
You can find a link to David DeVore's YouTube video at thenewnpr.org.